morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Flom and I are very pleased to have sitting with us today Judge Duryagian of the Northern District of Illinois, sitting by designation. We're grateful to him for helping us with our work. So our first case for argument, Olson versus Brown, Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. An action brought on behalf of a class of county jail inmates represents the quintessential instance in which the class's claims are so inherently transitory that a district court cannot reasonably be expected to rule on a class motion before the named plaintiff's claims are rendered moot. When Mr. Olson filed this action on January 2nd, he had absolutely no idea that his individual claims would only be live for 13 days. For all he knew, his transfer could have occurred one day later or it could have occurred 6 months later. And the same uncertainty will surround any potential plaintiff who seeks to carry the class's torch in this case. This is so notwithstanding the undisputed fact that a class of persons suffering from the alleged deprivations is continuously in existence. The district court erred in its application of the Gerstein doctrine to this case and erred in dismissing as moot the plaintiff's claims without first determining whether the class could be certified. This decision must therefore be reversed. This case is on all fours with Gerstein, which of course forms the foundation.
No, it's not. Are there any jail cases like this?
There are a plethora of district court cases like this applying the inherently transitory.
No appellate cases?
The Second Circuit has applied Gerstein to a case like this, except for the fact that that every single person in that case was serving a definite sentence of at least 3 months. The sheriff has, of course, been unable to cite a single county jail case that went in the other direction in which the benefit of Gerstein was not applied. And Gerstein itself was...
You're saying there are no appellate cases.
Your Honor,
Your
Honor, I believe that Gerstein itself...
No. Cases involving jails.
Gerstein was a case involving a jail, Your Honor.
I thought that was the 48-hour.
The 48 hours
business.
Was McLaughlin. At issue in Gerstein was the complete lack of any probable cause hearing, which meant that the claims of every single class member in Gerstein were live until the individual left that jail or were convicted of the offense that they were charged with. The only distinction between this case and Gerstein is that here there exists one additional event that may also render a named plaintiff's claims moot, in addition to the possibility of the dismissal of charges or release before charges are even filed, or trial and conviction or acquittal. Here there exists the possibility of an individual's transfer to the Department of Correction. However, this is a distinction without a difference, for like any of the other events that may render a named plaintiff's claims moot, this may occur at any moment, and the individual stay in the county.
Can he sue for damages?
Your Honor, it is possible that a damage suit would lie following his transfer. I think in a case like...
Why do you say it's possible? What's the obstacle?
Your Honor, it's there's no obstacle to the suit itself. I think any damages that Mr. Olson sustained may be minimal, and there isn't...
Well, really, you want him to remain in the case when he has absolutely no benefit from it. Now you're saying, well, the damages would be small, so it wouldn't motivate him to sue.
Your Honor, Garrity itself says that an individual who's... claim was live, who had the necessary interest at the stake of...
Yeah, but he has no interest anymore, and if he brought a suit for damages, he'd have an interest, even if it weren't enormous.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, but if that were the rule, then Gerstein necessarily falls, McLaughlin falls, Swisher falls. Indeed, even the entire line of cases around SOSNA would necessarily fall because, of course, class certification is something that may be revisited at any time. There's no question.
The concern behind cases like SOSNA is with a defendant who buys off the class representative successively, then you never get anywhere. That's the problem.
Your Honor, I think that's certainly one concern, but the other concern here is that is that you get nowhere with solving the problem for the class members who have this constant claim if you are not going to let a class...
Some of these people stay in for months, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Approximately half of the individuals in the jail are there for more than 3 months. But at the outset of the case or at the outset of their incarceration, there's no way of determining...
Well, I named several class representatives. Also, you might have a good idea at the outset who is going to be there a long time, who is just in transit to a prison, and who, on the other hand, was awaiting trial in a busy district.
Your Honor, I think it's possible to get some inkling. I think that's not something that's easy, but by any measure.
I don't understand.
Even an individual awaiting trial in a busy district may have their bond reduced, may have charges dismissed for a plethora of different reasons that would render their individual claims moot. If the rule were such that you simply had to bring a class action like this with numerous plaintiffs, or you had to keep on intervening someone, which is an exceedingly difficult proposition, particularly in light of the exhaustion requirements of the PLRA, then I...
Haven't there been a lot of cases in which district courts were administering jails, like the Cook County Jail? Didn't Judge Shader have a consent decree or something for many years dealing with the Cook County Jail?
I certainly believe that to be...
How did that case arise?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the specifics.
A lot of, you know, of these regulatory injunctions involving jails. I'm curious how they arose in light of the absence of appellate cases dealing with this problem.
Your Honor, I think there is not a lack of appellate cases. I think these courts apply this.
You said that there weren't any appellate cases that address this specific issue.
Excuse me, Your Honor. At the circuit court level, I believe that to be true.
And appellate cases, that's federal appellate cases or court of appeals or Supreme Court cases. So.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And I think Gerstein did address this issue and addressed...
Just keep going back to Gerstein. I'm asking, are there any other cases? Is that it?
There's Gerstein. There's the Zurek case in the Second Circuit decided shortly after Gerstein. And that after Gerstein, there was very little difficulty amongst the district courts in applying this to a county jail case, which was Gerstein, which I think would account for the lack of federal appellate-level decisions surrounding this issue. Gerstein and his progeny stand clearly for the proposition that the proper focal point in a case such as this, I'm quoting here, is on whether it is by no means certain that any individual named as plaintiff will have a live claim long enough to obtain a ruling on class certification. The sheriff in this case does not contest that lack of certitude and cannot contest it. Indeed, as I say, the sheriff is unable to cite a single case in which Gerstein was not applied in the county jail context. To the contrary, the sheriff urges on this court some form of mathematical calculation that has scarcely been hinted at amongst other courts and that would prove unworkable in practice. Even were this not so, the district court in this case understandably held Mr. Olson's class motion under advisement for a lengthier period of time than his entire stay at Tippecanoe County Jail, and held it under advisement for a lengthier period of time than most inmates' entire stays at the jail.
Mr. Rose, was any discovery requested during that time?
Your Honor, there was no discovery directly propounded to the sheriff. However, we had to engage in motion practice in order to obtain permission to send a questionnaire as at will to members of the class, and that too delayed a ruling.
Well, and did responses come to that inquiry?
It did several weeks later.
Well, wouldn't a district court be aided in getting a better read on a potential class if that kind of discovery had played out?
Absolutely, and I think it did play out, and it will often be the case where there is discovery necessary.
Well, I mean, so we would see how representative, first of all, the claim that's made here is.
Sure.
And it just seems to me that you could get more traction if if the, you know, I understand the individual plaintiff can be moved at any time, but in a prison with, or a county jail with several hundred inmates and a floating population, maybe a more representative number could have played out if discovery had produced that.
Forgive me, Your Honor. I'm not entirely sure what you mean by represent.
It seems to me that if we have a problem here, it would be better identified if we had a broader representation of the possible harm.
I think so, too, and I think Falcon itself commands that we be able to demonstrate not just that there are so many people in the jail, but that there are other people suffering this same harm, which made it such that this questionnaire that
well,
this...
Well, how do we determine that it wasn't a targeted move in Mr. Olson's case as opposed to a more endemic problem?
We don't, excuse me, Your Honor, you mean his transfer itself?
Yes.
We don't, and that's something that at the very least is difficult to indicate to determine, but at the very least it does underscore the necessity of applying Gerstein to cases such as this, because we can't determine whether this is intentional mootness or not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you a question about the merits. Now, there's this issue whether the court was reading mail outside of his presence with his lawyer. Was the ACLU or someone from the ACLU was actually representing him during this period, or what?
One piece of the mail was from our office, and we, as with anyone, as soon as someone contacts our office, that initiates the client for the purpose of legal advice, that initiates the attorney-client relationship.
So I don't understand. Just getting a letter from someone that creates a lawyer-client relationship?
When the individual seeks legal advice, our office was representing Mr. Olson during this period in the investigatory.
Was representing? Was there an agreement, a statement of representation, or what?
At this time, no, I don't believe there was, but as it applies to the merits, this court has already determined that a raw pleading of
that a
the
what?
Opening of. That a pleading of the opening of legal mail states.
Well, I thought legal mail was mail with your lawyer, not mail with someone else, some other lawyer.
Your Honor, courts have. There is no precise definition of legal mail that has emerged, and courts have gone back and forth over the precise contours of that right. However, as I say, this court has already decided that legal mail is a term of art. And that legal mail, by definition, is something that cannot be opened.
I don't understand you. Isn't legal mail with between a lawyer and someone the lawyer is representing?
Your Honor, I would argue that it's both that as well as mail.
Is there law on this?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there law on this question? What is legal mail?
Indiana's county jail standards define what cannot.
The standards is what we're talking about, the Constitution. So what is legal mail?
There is no law. Wolf v. McDonald set down the rule that legal mail is not something that can be opened.
Question is, what is legal mail?
It is at the very least mail from an individual's attorney.
But you are. Someone else in the ACLU was not actually representing Olson, was he? I don't mean Olson. Yeah, Olson wasn't actually representing him.
Your Honor, I would argue that we certainly were representing him.
How can you represent him without an agreement to represent him?
Your Honor, I think the attorney-client privilege begins to apply as soon as...
I don't understand that. What, you just send a letter to a lawyer and that creates... representation and the lawyer-client privilege attaches?
I think it does when you send that letter.
Where did that from?
I think that's the common law, or excuse me. I think that's a generally accepted definition of the privilege. Your Honor, I'm not entirely...
Hey, what if you write some lawyer in South Africa. You have a legal question, and he writes you back and answers you or something. You have a lawyer-client relationship with that person?
I think you do, Your Honor. Yes.
Do you have authority for that remarkable assertion?
Your Honor, I do not offhand. I would be happy to submit some as supplemental authority.
Oh, look it up. Okay, so thank you, Mr. Rose. So, Mr. Mason?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Doug Masson, attorney for Tracy Brown, Sheriff of Tippecanoe County. We obviously think Judge Sharp was correct. Mr. Olson's claim was solely...
How do you get around this Gerstein footnote?
It's not inherently transitory, this claim.
I'm sorry, it's not what?
Inherently transitory.
Well, how's it different from Gerstein? I don't understand you.
Gerstein, I believe, was...
The pretrial detention is ended, and it says... unlikely that any individual could have his constitutional claim decided on appeal before he's either released or convicted. So, it says it's certain that other persons similarly situated will be detained under the allegedly unconstitutional procedures. Why isn't that, why doesn't that describe this case?
The portion you've just read...
Pardon?
The portion you've just read seems to cover it, but I think further reading suggests that...
Further reading where?
I do not have... I'm sorry, I don't have the case...
Well, this is what the case is about.
Right.
So you ought to know what's in the footnote.
I'm mixing up my cases, and I've got the footnotes confused because there's several footnotes 11 that run together for me. I think Gerstein... was about
several
pretrial detention.
Several footnote 11s run together? What are you talking about?
I'm sorry. If you look at the footnotes of Gerstein, Sosna, Garrity, I believe an interesting piece of minutia is that they all start talking about the cases at footnote 11. But I think Gerstein is just talking about pretrial detention before they can have a hearing on whether there's probable cause to keep them. And the nature of that case is that there...
Well, what difference does it make? So I'm reading on in the footnote, length of pretrial custody cannot be ascertained at the outset, and it may be ended at any time by release on recognizance, dismissal of the charges, a guilty plea, etc., etc. The constant existence of a class of persons suffering the deprivation is certain. The attorney representing the named respondent is a public defender. He can safely assume that he has other clients with a continuing live interest in the case. That's the entire footnote. I don't see what you find in that that supports your position.
I believe what I got from that is further Seventh Circuit analysis of that.
Well, the Seventh Circuit can't overrule the Supreme Court, alas.
Well... That is true. What
Mr.
I can
Mass,
do, yes, sir.
Other than post-trial conviction prisoners, what's not inherently transitory about stay at a county jail?
The people there are there for an average of 139 days. Some are serving sentences on misdemeanor convictions.
No, I understand. So we don't have anywhere near the substantial population that we have in a prison, right? I mean, as far as tenure.
Correct. But I think the cases that have looked at some sort of time frame have looked at things like 70 days, 90 days, 120 days, NCAA versus Banks. And
well, here we have an average of 139 days, right?
Correct, and this has been longer.
How does the class action lawyer know whether his client is average? Or put differently, what's to prevent you, the state, from just transferring the person as soon as he files the lawsuit? When they substitute another representative, you transfer him.
I don't think the sheriff has unilateral discretion on transferring prisoners.
The sheriff. But the state, right? The state.
Well, the sheriff's the defendant here. He went to the state,
But the sheriff can go to the, you know, state's attorney general or something and say, look, let's get rid of this case. Move this guy. You've got other jails. What's to prevent that?
Well, I don't think they all have other places to go.
I'm sure they do. There's no other jail in Indiana that they couldn't move this guy to if they wanted to kill this case.
I suppose the concern
is that if you have a class representative who's in this, you know, transitory state, the defendant or the state can move him in order to try to moot the case.
If there were evidence of that, I think the district court would have to take a closer look at it. I don't think there's any evidence of that here. As he suggested, a claim for damages might then be put in there just to prevent that kind of procedural shenanigan, but of course that didn't happen here. And this concept...
Could he have found a class representative who is sure to be there for at least, I don't know, 6 months or whatever?
I don't know if anything's certain, Your Honor. You could certainly look at what the person was being charged with, what their sentence was, and have a better idea of whether that was likely or not. But I don't think certitude is what's required here.
Do you think a case challenging a class action or injunction case challenging jail conditions could ever avoid a mootness charge, a mootness defense?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if Mr. Olson had brought the case as soon as he learned of the supposedly illegal conduct of the sheriff, filed his suit, and alerted the district court judge that...
Filed his suit in what, in one day or something?
I don't know if it needs to be one day, but within 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, some of these people, to avoid dead on arrival...
I usually ask people to file suits within 2 or 3 weeks, right?
Well, you don't, but these pretrial detainee cases where they're being held without bond, I think a number of them had to be filed very quickly in order to avoid the dead on arrival issue, which is what had happened. There's no question that when the case is dead on arrival, they don't have standing before they file suit. There's no chance of this exception laid out by Sosna and Gerstein applying. The exception has been made, but the door was only opened a small way.
Now, in your view, the case would be moot if he were transferred any time before class certification. Is that your view?
That's my view for this case, for a county jail case. If the nature of the claim, something about the claim itself was going to expire, and the courts haven't set a firm number of days, but within a month or two, then this exception for inherently transitory cases would apply.
Well, now you're saying if the claim would expire within 2 months, then the exception applies? That's your rule you're suggesting?
If there's something about the claim itself, for example, the cases where people are being held too long without a probable cause determination, there's something, the Florida case, Gerstein, I believe it was a 30-day period they were held.
What if he were scheduled to be moved in 2 months, then?
Well, then that's just...
The exception would apply?
No, sir, because that's personal to him. There's nothing about his class. If all inmates were scheduled to be moved in a period such as 2 months, then that would make the claims of this class inherently transitory instead of merely potentially transitory.
Yeah, but a very small percentage of this prison population stays a year, right?
Correct, Your Honor, about 8%.
Right. So we've got a pretty fluid turnover, don't we?
there is a pretty fluid turnover. But I think the concern of the Supreme Court was to just create an avenue by which claims weren't barred entirely for entirely from review. I think if there is a champion that can be found,
wouldn't they?
I'm sorry.
If you weren't in that 8%, then see, I don't know how it works. Someone brings a suit. So was there a bunch of people, Judge Plummet, there's a bunch of people, they're there for a year. But suppose the first class representative, he thought he was going to be there a year, but he's moved after a month. And then the next guy comes and so on. And at the end of a year, it could be you'd run through all these class representatives, all the cases had been dismissed. Now these people have been in there a year. There's no way they can challenge the case, right? How do you deal with that problem?
I mean, under those facts, they would all expire.
Right.
But I think the fact that there's a reasonable potential of having there are a group of people who can bring it.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? You have this whole sequence of cases. One person is the class representative. His suit is dismissed because he's transferred. They have someone else. He's transferred. It goes on and on. I mean, what's the point of that?
Well, I think the point of it is courts limiting their power to actual cases and controversies.
But
and
it's obviously there is a controversy, at least with these 8% people who... All these people are being subjected, let's say hypothetically, to invasion of their constitutional rights, but there doesn't seem to be any procedure by which they can ever get that issue litigated, adjudicated.
It's much harder as an injunctive case. If they brought a suit for damages, then they can right away get. I mean, there's no chance of this getting swept under the rug if it's brought that way.
Stein also, right?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So it's not quite as compelling an argument as you're suggesting.
Perhaps not.
If there is such a pernicious policy, and I'm obviously not suggesting there is, why wouldn't an injunction rather than a damage action be the way to initially attempt to address it?
Well, for one thing, to try and get out of this mootness conundrum they found themselves in.
Well,
but also, I think injunctive relief is an appropriate attempt at a solution, but I think the courts have limited themselves and tried to avoid what Mr. Olson is now, which is essentially a concerned bystander attempting to get some relief that won't do him a bit of good.
Yeah, but that's often true of a class representative after certification, right?
That's true.
So what's special about this?
Well, in the class certification issue is special because the class then has been deemed to have its own independent rights.
Yeah, that's a lot of talk. But the fact is that if the class representative claim has become moot, nevertheless, he may be replaced. He often is replaced, but he doesn't have to be replaced. So he could continue on as the class representative, even though he had no further interest in the case. So why would we permit that, but you don't want to permit this?
Well, I think it comes from how the class action system evolved after the mootness doctrine was created, and the courts have limited their authority. But then they saw this new class action procedure, and they had to give it some recognition.
Well, they could have said what you want to say. They could have said if the class representative's claim is settled or, you know, resolved or abandoned or what have you, then he has to get out of the case and you have to find someone else. Could have said that.
But I don't think they did. I don't think the Supreme Court has held that. I think they've only opened the door slightly to get around a mootness concept that they took very seriously.
That what?
to get around a mootness concept that they took very seriously. The Supreme Court has limited its own authority.
Well, if they abandon that in the case where the class has been certified, why not before the class is certified?
Well, I think then because you just might as well get rid of the mootness doctrine altogether.
No, you'd limit it to cases where there was a real problem in getting an adjudication before the case became moot.
I can only argue from what I see as the cases that have been provided, and I think the Supreme Court has only opened the door a slight amount.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mason. Mr. Rose, how much time does he have? 1 minute? Have anything further?
Your Honor, I have very little time remaining. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions from the Court.
We don't have to decide the class certification issue if we determine it's not moot, right?
No, absolutely not. This Court could, of course, remand to a district court for determination of class certification, and if the district court determines that the class isn't certifiable, then dismissal is probably...
Well, Ms. Rose, and under what has been developed or not developed in this case, wouldn't that be a more appropriate than for us to determine that certification should attend?
I think it's certainly within this Court's discretion to remand for a determination in the first place.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Mason, and thank you to both sides.